The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Today on Campus Voices, we're up in the Old College Gallery, where Ryan Thornton and Sam O'Donnell and I are looking at the exhibition Fashion All Fronts, Stories from the Wardrobe, 1914 to 1918. That'll be up in the Old College Galleries through December 8th. And we'll be talking with Belinda Orzada, a professor of fashion and apparel studies, and with Delia Lopez-Gaidosh, an assistant professor of fashion and apparel studies, and also the curator of UD's historic costume and textile collection. And from the University Library and Special Collections, we have Jan Gardner-Broski, the collections manager. Delia, the name of this exhibition that we're standing in is?
Fashion on All Fronts, Stories from the Wardrobe, 1914 to 1918.
I mean, this is just fascinating. We've got everything in here from military uniform to lots of women's clothing. I guess the idea is that a lot of the women's clothing had impact from the uniforms.
That is actually one of the results of the war. This is sort of featuring World War I, or the Great War as it was known then, and how it impacted people's lives, not only on the war front, but also on the home front. And we're looking at it from the point of view of clothing. And so, yes, that was one of the results in which we see the influence of military dress in not only men's dress, but also women's dress and even children's. Right here, we have a sailor suit that was actually very popular. This idea of the midi blouse or sailor ensembles for children and women. And they didn't necessarily connect to a particular war at the moment. It was just part of fashion, part of sportswear. And so what's interesting, during this time, it became even more prominent as the war was going on. And so what's fascinating is we have the women's ensemble in front, but behind we actually have a sailor uniform from World War I. And you can see the similarities from the patch with the eagle on the side to the stripe on the sailor collar, and of course the color and even the cut of the blouse. So yeah, it was very popular, but it's something that started in the late 19th century. It really became prominent during the war because it was something with, you know, military style. And it continued, by the way, into the 1920s, this idea of the sailor or midi blouse, which of course was embraced as part of athletic wear for women. So what you see over there would be an ensemble for gym class. What we were trying to replicate here was, I found an article in the Delineator, which was a women's magazine of the time. They talk about students from Vassar College and how they wore the kind of ensemble, which was their gym clothes, to help the cause, to work out on the field and knit socks and so on. So that's what we're saying here is not only sportswear was important, but also it was being used also as part of the clothing to help the cause in the home front.
Some of this clothing looks flapperish, and some of it seems formal, and some of it seems informal.
We have a little bit of everything. We started with this concept, the university, actually, a few years back. A few faculty members and members from libraries and museums, we got together to consider the war and how can we memorialize it. And what's interesting is, this started in 2014. The idea was that there would be events every year instead of just having it at the beginning, at the end. And so we got 2017. From this concept of, okay, what can we do about the war, we went through our collection and started looking at anything that would be within the time frame of. And so what was fascinating is it wasn't just women's evening wear, it was a little bit of everything. As you look at the women's garments right here, or the gowns, you can see the evolution from before the war, the effects of the war, of the shorter hemline, the fuller skirt, the lack of color. And of course, then as we get away from the war, you can actually start seeing more the what would be known as the flapper silhouette. So yes, you actually know what you're talking about in this evening gown right here.
Let's go over and take a closer look at it.
It's actually a dinner dress, and it's from 1919. And the story goes that the person who made it came to her home. So the donor actually wrote a little note saying it was for an event. So it was a nice way of sort of ending what we start, you know. So you can see the evolution of what happened during the war. So you can even see, you know, drop waist versus a higher waistline. And of course, by now, we're not wearing any corset. The brassiere is becoming more and more common, even in the shape. It's sort of fun trying to pad these ladies to the right silhouette.
And this has got some pattern of shiny stuff over it and a blue sash. What's been done to make it shine? Is it?
It's actually, those are beads. For the 1920s, this will be very common. The 1920 silhouette will be very straight and plain if you look at it from that standpoint. And so what happens is it's more like an open canvas. And so it's all about the decoration. We're moving into what will become the 1920s, which is all about beading. And so we're seeing all these beautiful bugle beads, but there's also some embroidery here. So there's a combination of bugle beads and embroidery. The dress is almost 100 years old. And so some of them are in amazing condition and other ones are in, they need it at some TLC.
Is this a dress and a jacket?
Yeah, this is an afternoon dress. And actually this was made by a woman from Wilmington. She had a dressmaking shop, Mary E. McDowell. What's fascinating about her is after a while she shut down her business and next thing you know she was in banking. And then as I was rummaging, you know, through the archives trying to find out about her in newspapers, she was involved in a case in Philadelphia about money laundering and so on. So, you know, this is part of the exhibition is the stories that the garments, what we found out, not just about the person, but maybe even behind the scenes. So, but this is a beautiful example of 1918 in which now that we're moving, the war is almost done. And because there was rationing of fabrics, the silhouette got more straight. And there was this idea of using less fabric in comparison to like 1914 and 16, which the skirt
got
really
fabric.
Wide.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
There's one more feature in this Mary McDowell dress I wanted you to talk about, and that's the embroidery and the beadwork on the front of the dress.
Yeah, so it's, again, this dress is before our dinner dress, so it's showing you the trend. The 1920s is going to be all about embroidery and beading. So just a tiny little panel is enough to then, when you compare it to the dinner dress, you see so much more. And of course, if we would be in the 1920s, looking at 1920s dresses would be an extreme amount of beading. I mean, that was what it was all about. It's an example of after the war, because during the war, beading was not necessarily a part of the decoration or even too much color because of the lack of dyes, since the dyes for textiles really came from Germany. And with the war, that was sort of cut off. If you notice, the color palette is very subdued. It isn't just the dyes, but also it's the fibers. At one point, there was a need to save all the wool for the war effort. So you see then a fashion for a lot of garments made out of cotton. It's sort of almost going back to the beginning of the 19th century and that Regency period when all women were wearing all these cotton muslin dresses. We see that movement here again because of the war. It was necessity. And even the silhouette, if you notice, originally it's very more form-fitting and more restrictive. And when you come around and if you look at then how it gets wider, because it was about functionality. I mean, everybody talks about World War II and Rosie the Riveter and women taking men's roles, but women during the Great War did the same thing at home. And wearing garments with many more layers and more form-fitting was not very functional. So we do see a change into a silhouette that is shorter and fuller and looser. And again, it was a result of functionality.
Can you describe what this kind of poster is and how it was relevant during the time period?
Well, posters were used for many reasons, and the most was to actually advertise the war as a product. You know, we think about propaganda and the kinds of things that propaganda means to us that are sometimes pejorative or not such good thoughts, but in this case, it was to encourage and to enlighten a group of people in the United States who were involved in non-intervention in the war. And so they were, isolated from the war until it became necessary for us to become a part of it, the people in the United States. This particular poster is called Wake Up America Day, and it features a woman with her arms outstretched, dressed in a tricorn hat and holding up a lantern in one hand and the American flag in the other hand. Interestingly enough, a 48-star flag, which would have been common in, and it says April 19th, 1917. And this is actually Patriot Day, and it would have been celebrated for the Lexington and Concord battle. But in this case, it was a recruitment parade because the United States had just entered the war on April 6, 1917. And you see the date April 19th. So this was a huge recruitment effort in the five boroughs of New York City. The particular poster is done by James Montgomery Flagg, who was just a leading illustrator, and I think most folks would remember James Montgomery Flagg as the guy who created the Uncle Sam pointing and saying, "Uncle Sam wants you," for the U.S. Army. In this case, he was one of the most prolific illustrators of posters for the First World War, and this shows an image of Jean Earle Moule, who was an actress in New York, and she is dressed as Paul Revere, saying, "Wake up, America." And actually, in the parade, the recruitment parade in New York City, she was again dressed in full Revolutionary War costume and on a horse, riding through the streets of New York in the parade. The other interesting thing to note about this particular poster, it's very interesting, even though it's supposedly a Revolutionary War garment, it very much echoes what's next to it here with the garments here, using the shirt waist and a skirt, which is a very forward-looking, and again, as Delia mentioned before, a kind of functional thing for women who were beginning to work outside of the home, who were beginning to go to college and so forth, and become more professional kinds of women. They needed garments that were going to relate, things that they could change around and so forth. So the shirt waist, which was modeled on a men's shirt, as well as the skirt, became very, very popular. And so putting the poster next to these particular garments in the exhibition makes perfect sense, plus the fact that it's just a really eye-catching poster. Uncle Sam is shown as kind of the symbol of the United States. And actually, Uncle Sam had been around for quite some time. In earlier wars, provisions were created by a man by the name of Sam. Each of the barrels of provisions that were sent out, the letters U.S. were stenciled on the barrels. And of course, it meant United States. But the soldiers and so forth said, well, you know, these provisions are from Uncle Sam's because of the person who sold the provisions to the army. But Uncle Sam, particularly in this one, it's Uncle Sam Needs Heat. And it's kind of a ghostly apparition type figure that has his hand laid on the shoulder of a young man shoveling coal into a furnace and saying, don't overdo with your resources. Save some. Uncle Sam needs it for the troops in the war effort. Also, we have another poster in the other gallery where Uncle Sam is kind of the salesman for Liberty Bonds. And so without having that stern finger pointing at you, his one hand is extended towards you as if to shake your hand, while his other points over his shoulder. And in the background, you can see things like a flotilla of Navy vessels and airplanes in the sky and doughboys marching. And so he's basically saying, can you give some of your dollars for the boys overseas? So Uncle Sam really becomes the personification of the United States. And it wasn't until like 1961 or 62, the United States Congress actually made him the symbol of the United States.
You'll be hosting a talk in November about all of these posters, right?
That's correct. On the 15th of November, which is a Wednesday, starting at 12:15, I'll be talking about all of these posters that are here that have been generously lent by the Special Collections University Library. The lecture will actually be in both of the galleries here in Old College. As is, all of our events were free and open to the public, and I would be delighted to come and talk to you all about the posters that will be on view. Certainly, I hope it raises some questions and some conversations.
This was really a interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, whatever term you want to use to describe it, because we had undergraduate, graduate students in a conservation and collections management class that Professor Lopez Gaidash taught last year. We've had a number of volunteers work with it at all levels. So the concepts kept growing based on the discoveries that we were making within our collection and the discoveries that we made in the special collections with the posters.
Professor Orzada, I don't see like a long train or anything on these wedding dresses.
Right, that has really evolved over time. And you can see you've got kind of traditional ivory colors with two of the dresses and a non-traditional color with the third one. People were encouraged at a certain point during the war, okay, don't scrimp, make it an important occasion when you get married. But there's also the side for regular person. You can't afford to have a one-time wearing of a dress. And so you would see women who would have a special dress. Maybe it's their favorite color. There are a few special details. But she would wear that dress for the next 2-3 years or more, as long as it still fit her, for any special occasion. The blue dress actually was a conservation effort. It had not been stored carefully for a good part of its life, and so Professor Vicki Kassman and her students this summer, you know, soaked it and got some of the staining out and gave it a nice refresh. Actually, it has a personal connection because this was my foster grandmother's wedding dress. I was excited we were able to use it in the exhibition. But you can see that the dresses do follow the trends as far as the fullness of the skirt, the length, right? We've got shorter, they're not all the way to the ankle. You know, we do have some fabric restrictions and so forth, so they're elaborate, but they're not what we in 21st century or late 20th century really associate with a huge ball gown wedding dress with a long train and so forth. It was a beautiful robin's egg blue. If you look to the side behind where the buttons are, you can see a brighter blue, and it has faded over time, unfortunately. Yes. Blue was her favorite color. I remember that about her. Yeah, she liked to wear blue, so I can picture her in that.
So we're standing in front of the Doughboy military uniform right next to the old Boy Scout uniform. And these two, when looking at them, look pretty similar. Can you talk about the similarities between the two?
Well, first of all, if you notice, they're all khaki, correct? So that's part of the story here, looking at the color scheme. Khaki became a very popular color. But the Doughboy uniform during the Great War, instead of trousers, it had breeches. And so you notice the fuller knee breeches. And then they protected the bottom part of their legs with puttees, which were these leg wraps, which they completely disliked. You also notice that he's actually dressed with the campaign hat. And so that hat was issued here in the U.S. And then when they made it to Europe, then they actually were given the overseas cap, which they liked much better because it's a foldable and easier to carry. Of course, this one would protect. But what's interesting is the Boy Scouts organization, which started in the teens, they based their uniform on military dress. And so this is what you are seeing here. And originally, this is an example from the late 20s, 26, 27. What you're seeing here is the second version. The original version, just like the Doughboy uniform, the top was a tunic. And so people were concerned that they had the idea that somehow the Boy Scouts were actually part of the military. I call it like, you know, the minor league team of the military. But they were very concerned about it because they wanted to be sure, ironically, to be sure that the Boy Scouts were not part of a political narrative. And so they redesigned the uniform at the end of the teens into the early 20s. And so the main thing that they changed was the top. I mean, they already had this, but this became the official. And it's just a shirt, and you tucked it in. But besides that, they continue wearing the breeches. And just like the Doughboy, at one point, they did have the leg wraps, but then After that, they got rid of their leg wraps and then they had knee socks. This guy is actually from a troop in Pennsylvania. It's the uniform from Mrs. Nancy Ryder. She's an alum, and this was her father's uniform. And the Girl Scouts, also an organization that also came about in the teens. We see here, it is missing the belt, and she would have been wearing bloomers. But if you notice, again, the khaki color, well, what's interesting is it's a dress, and it's very stylish in the similar silhouette of the time period. People were getting confused between Girl Scouts and just regular people wearing khaki colors during the war period, that the Girl Scouts then actually added this patch with a CS. So people realized that that's a Girl Scout, not just somebody wearing a khaki dress, because khaki became a very popular color during this time. It was almost a sign of patriotism.
Well, you mentioned how the people wore a lot of khaki as a way to be patriotic during the war effort. Were there any other styles that the public might be into as a way to support the war effort?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you asked me that, because you could buy a uniform and wear it. You could even order from Sears. All these voluntary organizations, they all came up with their own uniforms as a sign, like a common manner of dress, people wearing some form of uniform for children, for women, for adults. Because again, it was sort of a sign of supporting the cause. Even, and then fashion also adopted elements of military dress. So we have that one suit back there that was made in 1918 or 1917. It was actually made by the Burnup brothers, which were tailors in Philadelphia. But what was amazing about this suit is we have it here, because then you can compare it to Gabrielle's, as we call it, the YMCA, the YMCA Expeditionary Force suit. If you look at the style, again, it's a similar, very much the same silhouette, and then this beautiful teal suit has embroidery that is, you know, inspired by military style. But this suit is made out of silk, so it's a fashion suit. And yeah, women also actually accessorize with ties, neckties, and that, again, as part of that military dress, military look. But unfortunately, because this is made out of weighted silk, it's in very poor condition. Weighted silk is a process in which they added metallic salts. Thank you to the textiles, or they finished the textile with metallic salt. With 100 years later, what it's done is it weakens the fiber, and many of these garments, you pick them up and they just shred. The inside, we had to remove it because it was actually becoming powder and it was becoming dangerous, a health hazard. The student that worked on this a few years back, he had to wear masks and it was getting on his skin. So, I mean, ended up wearing gloves and everything. Well, out of a sad situation came something amazing. They discovered the tag of the actual woman that made the suit, who worked for the Verna brothers. And he went on and researched her, and she was this African-American woman from Philadelphia who was a dressmaker. She at one time had her own business, and then she had to close it down, and then she got a job with these tailors in Philadelphia. It's sort of the great stories that come out of these garments. It's more than just the beauty of them. It's the meaning and what it says about the time and the people who made them or wore them.
So Jan, I understand there's a story about this uniform that's been lent to us that you now call this Gabrielle.
Yes, we do. It's in honor of Gabrielle Rzeszka, who in 1916 was a very forward-looking young woman. This was before the United States was involved in the hostilities in Europe. She decided she wanted to go overseas and just see what this war was all about. And in those days, there weren't a lot of rules in place for American nationals to go overseas. And so she went to the passport office, and basically they said, "Do you have to go?" And she said, "Yes." And so they issued her a passport, and she stayed for about 3 months in Paris, where she was actually teaching mandolin lessons. But then she also went to the various areas and so forth and told stories in her diary, which we have here, telling stories about when they would have to have air raids or Big Bertha would be sounding off and they would take shelter. Then after that, she decided that she really needed to be a part of this war effort. And so she got in touch with the YMCA. And the YMCA had what they called huts at the war front. And these huts could take just about any form, from a commandeered house to a structure that was actually built. And this would be a place where the soldiers could come. They could get writing paper, cigarettes. They had libraries in them. Sometimes they weren't much more than dugouts near the trenches. And so Gabrielle worked as a worker in one of these huts. And basically, these were the kinds of the forerunners to things such as the USO. Absolutely. And so the YMCA and the Salvation Army were involved in these kinds of R&R places for the soldiers. And Gabrielle Rozeska worked in them. And sometimes when they went out to dole out hot chocolate to the soldiers, sometimes they got a little bit close to the fighting front and were not aware of it. And so there was a lot of naivete, but a lot of bravery. There was a lot of rotten, hot, dark, nasty work that went on in the war effort. And Gabrielle was one of these modern women that did not shirk any task that was placed in front of her. And the uniform that she wore was very similar to those that were worn by nurses. It's a very, very heavy, heavy wool gabardine fabric. It weighs a ton. It's actually in impeccable condition when you consider the age of the uniform, but it very much has the military styling and so forth that was copied by the Verna Brothers suit that Delia told you about. The headgear that was worn was normally a high-crowned hat, so the women also opted to wear the French beret. And this fabric was, again, not only heavy and protected against wind and weather and so forth, but it was also partially waterproof just because of the weight of it.
We have run out of time, and we haven't even gotten to the section of the exhibition talking about Delaware, or the things I wanted to learn more about were the shoes and the hats and things. So, folks, you've got to get up here to the Old College Gallery for this exhibition. Like all the University of Delaware Museum exhibitions, they are open Wednesday noon to 8 p.m. and Thursday through Sunday noon to 5 p.m. And this exhibition, Fashion on All Fronts, Stories from the Wardrobe, 1914 to 1918, is so big that it takes up both of the galleries here at Old College through December 8th.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM. WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at WVUD.org.